Okay, look, we have got exactly 1 hour and 19 minutes left. And I got quite a bit to cover today. Ha-ha. Yes, there it is. I've got 10 minutes for the first six and then 20 minutes for the last one. Ha-ha, we'll see if I'm able to deliver. But before I do that, there are review sessions. All is not lost. Review sessions on Thursday and Friday, 3:30 to 5 in 3 LeConte. That's around the corner here. And I think the final exam for those who dare to take an in-class exam, Hearst 227. I think that's right now. It's not right on your. It's not right on the exam. I think I put 220 on that one. It's 227, and that's on the 20th, a Saturday, December the 20th, from 12:30 to 3:30. Okay. All right. Summary. No questions. Any questions? Any questions? Okay. Summary. Good. Oh, I got 3 points to my summary. First, Fanon, Franz Fanon, studies two sets of relations. One set is the relation between the colonizer and the colonized. And the second set are the internal class relations within the colonized. And so we generate a picture that looked as follows. In a metropolitan country, metropolis, then we had the settlers, that's for Algeria at least, and then we had the administration, the colonial administration. Those are the dominant group, the colonizers, usually of a color white, in fact, definitively white, as opposed to the colonized, black for Fanon, but one might emphasize, of course, that actually they're much more differentiated by culture and by tribe and by ethnicity than Fanon gives credit. He insists that they are black but divided by class, and so he has a class analysis of the colonized, which goes as follows. We have the national bourgeoisie with a bunch of intellectuals here. Intellectuals. And underneath we have a small working class, which he refers to the pampered class, a parasitical class that has every interest in the reproduction of the existing class structure. They are a labor aristocracy. The national bourgeoisie, their aspirations are to replace the administrators and settlers in the decolonization road. That's on the one side. This is the urban bloc, which we call the urban bloc. And then on the other side, we have the rural bloc. And here we find what? We find the peasantry and the tribal leaders, who are often the transmission belt of the colonizers. So that's. And then we have one other class which we call the lumpen proletariat. They are basically people who are dispossessed of land in the rural areas, flee to the towns where they find themselves with usually often without jobs or without permanent jobs. The lumpen proletariat, we'll call them LP. And what Fanon is arguing, what he's very arguing, is that there are essentially two potential classes among the colonized that can become hegemonic, can represent their interests as the interests of all. The national bourgeoisie, on the one side, and the peasantry, helped by intellectuals that have fled from the towns. These are the radical intellectuals, which in combination with the peasantry, forge a vision of the peasants as the class that represents the interests of all, the interests, of course, in socialism. So what the picture is we had last time is essentially there are two struggles going on simultaneously. On the one hand, a war of movement. On the one hand, a war of movement that is trying to, in a sense, eliminate colonialism, but also at the same time a war of position, within the colonized, as to which of these two basic classes will represent the interests of all, which of these two classes will actually represent the future post-colonial context. On the one hand, there is the national bourgeoisie, essentially want to replace the colonizers, and on the other hand, the peasantry, who want a transformation of the social structure, a revolution towards socialism. Those are the two roads out of the colonial context. And so essentially there is a struggle, a war of position for the loyalty of the lumpen proletariat and the tribal leaders. Which of these two basic classes will acquire the support of these two sort of contradictory groups? Yeah. Actually, that's a summary of, there's 2 points there. There is the class structure and what I just described as this war of position, war of movement. Those are my, that's my first, that's two summary statements, two summary points there. Are there any questions about that? Jason.
My understanding that the class interest of the peasantry is land reform, which is basically reshuffling private property. How is that the basis for socialism?
Right, good Trotskyist question. Yes. Well, if you read Fanon, and we'll get to the, what the socialism means, he's basically got an idea that the peasantry form a communal solidarity that can be the foundations of a new resurrected socialist civil society. We'll get to that later on when we talk about the point number three, the National Liberation Road. But essentially the idea is that the peasantry are the revolutionary class and they will constitute a new civil society. That's the idea. It is very much against Marxist orthodoxy, whether it's Marx, whether it's Lenin, whether it's Gramsci, or whether it's even Trotsky. I know it's hard for you to swallow. But we'll get to that, I think there's something really fundamental at stake, which we'll get to in point number five. Okay. Good question. Right, my last point on the summary. Eden, right? Eden asked me last time, she said to me whether I would like to address the following question. Has there been more blood spilt over... What did you say? What was the question, Eden? Over the Communist Manifesto or the Holy Bible? Well, that's an interesting empirical question that you may want to examine. I mean, a lot of blood has been spilt in a sense over both of these documents. But I think that's a badly formulated question, if you excuse me. I think one has to think about, and this is really what is what obviously you're raising, is that, again, the question of violence. Now, I want to emphasize what Aaron said, that we only when we come to Fanon do we start talking about violence. Lenin had already talked about violence, and we shouldn't let him off the hook. But Lenin's notion of violence is about what? It is about the destruction of a regime. Lenin does not claim that violence is therapeutic. Lenin does not claim that violence is builds unity, nor does he claim, as far as I know, that violence leads to an illumination, understanding of social structure. This, for Fanon, is in a sense unique in this regard, in seeing the positive functions of violence in building unity, cleansing, and in sort of helping people understand the world. So this is, so what I want to first stress is, Eden, is that one has to think of violence fought around, whether it's the Bible or whether it's the Communist Manifesto, one has to think about it in terms of class structure, in terms of the patterns of domination. Violence, for Fanon, is about, on the one hand, the way the colonizers maintain their domination. And on the other hand, it is the way in which the colonized can overthrow that domination. So it is always seen in the context of a particular form of class domination. And I think that we have to restore that social structural context if we're ever going to talk about violence. It is all very well for us to attack those, shall we say, who we call what? Terrorists. But one mustn't forget in the process that the state itself often acts in a terroristic way. That we should be very careful when we sort of label certain groups as violent, not recognizing that other groups also are violent. The violence of the state, the colonial state, or the US state, or the Iranian state, or the Iraqi state, whatever, has to be examined empirically, as well as the violence of those who oppose it. So we have to see violence in this dialectical, I'll never use that word ever again, that dialectical way. Yes. Now, of course, I mean, I'm not getting into the violence that involved the Crusaders, for example, which were struggles between religious groups, and that, to what, how one does a class analysis of that, well, that's at this point beyond me, perhaps not beyond some of you. But anyway, but at least when we're talking about Marxism, what we see is that Marxism has been the ideology of what? A Stalinist state in the Soviet Union that did indeed exercise violence over subjugated populations. This was not a dictatorship of the proletariat, but a dictatorship over the proletariat in the name of Marxism. Just as a lot of movements have used the ideology of Marxism in opposition to violent regimes of a capitalist character. So every time I think we have to restore the context of violence. Okay, are there any questions on that? Violence, going, gone. Eden, do you want to say anything? Good. Yes. I think the most controversial moment of Fanon is this idea that somehow violence has this positive moment, not just destroying a regime, but also building unity, being cathartic, removing in a sense the internalized oppression of centuries, well, of decades anyhow, and of illuminating social structure. And I think it was formulated last time, we have to think about the conditions under which a violent struggle against a violent regime, under what conditions does that lead to more violence? Under what conditions does violence beget violence? Under what conditions does violence is violence contained by a social structure? A very interesting question, which you can write about in your honors thesis. Okay, that's the end of summary. Ah, Jessica.
So Fanon is the only person who presents the positive aspect of violence.
Well, certainly in this course, I'm just thinking. I don't know of anybody else who's as clear and upfront about it as Fanon is. Am I? Anybody over here? No, I think.
All the other theorists use violence as a tactic to get rid of the state.
Yes, as a tactic to get rid of the state or to impose rule. Yes, they don't. Yes, Matthew.
When you said Lenin doesn't say, so Lenin does not say that violence builds unity.
Come to the review. Yes, no, it's an interesting question.
Okay.
So that's why I was dancing around, but Kristen gave you the best possible answer that I could give you.
Okay.
Yes, that's interesting. I think that Fanon thematizes violence because he sees how colonialism itself was so violent, and so he focuses on violence and sees that perhaps the only way, that's his psychiatric moment, the only way of emancipating people from that internalized oppression is through a sort of violent catharsis. It's a very controversial claim, but anyway, I think it goes further than Lenin would. Lenin's not really interested. He hasn't got a notion of internalized oppression. It's all a bit thin, the oppression for Lenin. You know? Smash the state and Bob's your uncle. Yeah. All right, now we're going to move on. I did pretty well. What's the time? Only 5 minutes behind. Right. The National Bourgeois Road. You see, we got to have two roads. There's this road, the one in which the National Bourgeoisie are the hegemonic class representing its interests of all, as opposed to the peasantry. These are the two alternative classes, are the foundations of these two roads out of colonialism. So what about the National Bourgeois Road? What does Fanon have to say about that? Well, what does Fanon have to say about that? Yes, Lauren?
It will not work.
It will not work. Same meaning what? Very good. What will happen? The National Bourgeoisie, as in most of Africa, take over power in the sense that they do what? They actually occupy positions that were hitherto occupied by the colonizers. What happens to that form of post-colonialism, Marianne? All right, you end up with the same thing. The class structure is the same. The social structure is similar. Just the color of the people who occupy places may change. But what happens to that over time? Yeah. What happens to that over time? Jessica? New what? What is it that the National Bourgeoisie in the colonial, post-colonial context cannot do, as opposed to the bourgeoisie in the advanced capitalist context? They cannot... Come on. What cannot they do? Greg, what do you think? They cannot, what is, look, right, just imagine the bourgeoisie in advanced capitalism. It establishes a hegemony by doing what?
Intellectuals.
Yes, intellectuals present their interests as the interests of all. So how, but what is the material foundation of that? How is it that the dominant class is able to present its interests as the interests of all? How is it that we're able to do that in this country? Through what? Concessions, yes, exactly, concessions. And what is it that the National Bourgeoisie cannot do in the colonial context? It cannot accumulate wealth. It cannot expand. It cannot develop the what? Forces of production, yes. The forces of production, 175. 175. I'm going to read to you. 175, the new paragraph. The new paragraph, line 5. Come on, this is the last day of classes. Neil, where's your reader? Come on, wakey, wakey. This is the most exciting moment of the semester. It's nearly all over. Okie dokie. Are you there, Neil? What page are you asking me? 175. 175, new paragraph. Hey, Neil, your book is not underlined. What's the problem?
Photographic memory.
Good answer. 175. The bourgeoisie there. Read it out. So that Sienna can hear you.
The bourgeois phase and underdeveloped...
Not quickly, slowly.
The bourgeois phase and underdeveloped countries can only justify itself insofar as the national bourgeoisie has sufficient economic and technical strength to build up a bourgeois society, to create the conditions necessary for the development of a large-scale proletariat, to mechanize agriculture, and finally to make possible the existence of an authentic national culture.
Very good. A bourgeoisie needs that material basis to build its hegemony. A bourgeoisie similar to that which developed in Europe is able to elaborate an ideology and at the same time strengthen its own power, an ideology which represents its interests as the interests of all. Such a bourgeoisie, dynamic, educated and secular, has fully succeeded in its undertaking of the accumulation of capital and has given to the nation a minimum of prosperity. That is the West. Europe. In underdeveloped countries, on the other hand, we have seen that no true bourgeoisie exists. There is only a sort of little greedy caste, avid and voracious, with a mind of a huckster, only too glad to accept the dividends that the former colonial power hands out to it. This get-rich-quick middle class shows itself incapable of great ideas or of inventiveness. It remembers what it has read in European textbooks, and imperceptibly it becomes not even the replica of Europe, but its caricature. This is a degenerate national bourgeoisie. It does not have the economic foundations for constituting what? Hegemony, which requires civil society, which requires a whole range of institutions, and above all requires the granting of concessions to subordinate classes. It cannot do that. And so the national bourgeoisie, when it takes power in a post-colonial context, is an imitative bourgeoisie, and as Fanon says, has spiritual penury. It is without any sort of vision, imagination about what it is about. It is guilty of conspicuous consumption, page 156. It is only concerned with replacing the colonists, page 157. It is an intermediary agent of the foreign bourgeoisie, page 152. And it is a place of tourism, a playground of the Western bourgeoisie, page 151 and 154, a brothel of Western Europe. Right? So, this is an imitative, degenerate national bourgeoisie that cannot really establish any hegemony. It, in the end, can only establish what? If not hegemony, what then, Simeon?
Domination.
Domination, but that's hegemony. Hegemony is a form of domination.
Repression.
Repression, dictatorship, and despotism. And if you read, continue to read this chapter, if you talk about page 170, 172, 174, 182, 181, 184, 183, 167, 168, and page 170, you will discover that. You will discover that. You get all that, Lauren? Not quite. Yeah, basically about 160 to 170. You can read all those 10 pages. But the argument is very simple. In the post-colony, the national bourgeois road starts off as a multi-party democracy, and then it becomes a single-party democracy because it cannot afford multi-party democracy. So it has a single-party democracy, and then from a single-party democracy, it becomes a single-party dictatorship, and from a single-party dictatorship, it becomes a one-man despotism. That is what Fanon says. Because it cannot build hegemony, the trajectory, the only possible trajectory, is towards dictatorship. The only possible trajectory is towards dictatorship. And Fanon has all sorts of nasty words to say about the national bourgeois road to the post-colonial context. He talks about the party as a mafia. He talks about a tribal dictatorship. And he talks about charismatic leaders as a screen between the party and the people. There is, he says, an inevitable degeneration of political rule towards dictatorship. And, sad to say, I think it's fair to say, that on the whole, much of Africa has indeed followed, perhaps not in such an extreme version, but some such road. Because the national bourgeoisie cannot constitute hegemony, cannot constitute the sort of rule that we find in the United States, in Western Europe, in Norway, in Sweden, in England, in France, and so on. Because it has not got the economic foundation to build that hegemony. The national bourgeoisie is an appendage of the Western bourgeoisie. Okay? And so, Fanon concludes, if the national bourgeois road is going to end up in such a catastrophe, there is only one alternative, Katie. And that is...
I can't see it.
You can't see it. Right, but somebody else help Katie out. Sunny?
National liberation.
The national liberation struggle, which will lead not to dictatorship, but to socialism. It's dictatorship or socialism. Or as they used to say, Rosa Luxemburg said, barbarism or socialism. So let us now look at the National Liberation Road. What does Fanon have to say about that? Which we're on to point number three. What is this socialism of the future? Which is what Jason was asking. Whew. Well... If you look at page 185, what is this? I'm going to give you a few clips here. 185, second line from the top. Now, immediately you notice the word the party. The party is not a tool in the hands of government. The party is not a tool in the hands of government as it is in the National Bourgeois Road. It is not a tool in the hands of government. Quite on the contrary, the party is a tool in the hands of the people. It is they who decide on the policy that the government carries out. Who does that remind you of? Gramsci. The idea of the modern prince. Communist Party, that is basically a party that is accountable to and responsive to the people it leads. And then if you go to the bottom of that paragraph on 185, four lines from the bottom of the paragraph, Fanon writes, the party should be decentralized in the extreme. It is the only way to bring life to regions which are dead, those regions which are not yet awakened to life. So it has to be a decentralized participatory democracy. And he has some wonderful things to say about building bridges. Now, building bridges is a metaphor of national participation, democratic participation in the construction and reconstruction of a country after colonialism. Whoa. And if you look at 187, for example, the new paragraph on that page, four or five lines from the bottom of that paragraph, Fanon says, we must create a national policy, in other words, a policy for the masses. We ought never to lose contact with the people which has battled for its independence and for the concrete betterment of its existence. And then if you go to the bottom of 187, three lines from the bottom, it says, the party should be the direct expression of the masses, not a dictatorship over the masses, but a direct expression of the masses. The party is not an administration responsible for transmitting government orders. It is the energetic spokesman of the incorrupt and the incorruptible defender of the masses. That's the people. 2, 4, 6, 7 lines down on that page, 188. One of the greatest services that the Algerian Revolution... Well, I'll continue. Revolution will have rendered to the intellectuals of Algeria will be to have placed them in contact with the people, to have allowed them to see the extreme ineffable poverty of the people, at the same time allowing them to watch the awakening of the people's intelligence and onward progress of their consciousness. This is, of course, he's talking about the ways in which radical intellectuals have built a close relationship with the peasantry that then represents the interests of all. And if you can go on to 189, you'll talk about, he again talks about people's participation, democratic participation, and you have a sense of the idea of a building of the institutions of counter-hegemony. And if you turn to one page 193, there you will see he talks about, well, again, participation in planning, page 193, 2, 4, 6, 8, 10, 11, 12 lines into the new paragraph on 193. Sienna, are you there?
12 lines.
Yes, in an undeveloped country. Starts on the left-hand side.
In an underdeveloped country, experience proves that the important thing is not that 300 people form a plan.
Not that 300 people form a plan and decide. Uh-huh.
Carrying it out, but that the whole people plan and decide, even if they take twice or three times as long.
Go on.
The fact is that the time taken up by explaining time walks and treating the worker as a human being, who will be caught up in the execution of the plan. People must know where they are going and why. Politicians should not ignore the fact that the future remains a closed book, so long as the consciousness of the people remains in perfect elementary and cloudy.
Right, good. So there's the idea of popular participation in planning, so that people have an understanding where society is going, that they, in a sense, are making history collectively together. It's not enough for a few people to build a bridge. Society must participate in the building of bridges and institutions of civil society. Okay, very good. And then he talks a lot about 197. He talks a lot about political education, about the importance of popular education, grassroots education, education for self-reliance on page 197. And then he talks on 204 to 205 about national hegemony. And let me read to you the last sentences of that chapter from the bottom, 246 lines from the bottom of 204. No. Yes, six lines. The living expression. Conrad!
The living expression.
Now look, this is the last lines of the chapter, Conrad. You've got to give it all your soul. Your body and your soul. Okay, see if you can do it. Why don't you stand up and do it? Come on, stand up. Come on. Very good. Come on, you can do it. Now turn to the... Just imagine your fan on, okay? You can do it.
The living expression of the nation is the moving consciousness of the whole of the people. It is the coherent, enlightened action of men and women. The collective building up of a destiny is the assumption of responsibility on a historical scale. Otherwise, there is anarchy, repression, and the resurgence of tribal parties and terrorism. The national government, if it wants to be national, ought to govern by the people and for the people. For the outcast and by the outcast. No leader, however valuable he may be, can substitute himself for the power of will.
Popular will.
And the national government, before concerning itself about international prestige, ought first to give back their dignity to all citizens, fill their minds and feast their eyes with human things, and create a prospect that is human because conscious and sovereign men will be.
Well done. Spoken like a true follower of Obama. Very good. Very good. Very good. So this is the idea of a... Who does this remind you? Does this remind you of Gramsci or Lenin? Is this Gramsci or Lenin we're talking about? This socialist hegemony. When do you think? Is it the DFP or the regulated society? Ha ha. Tricky question. Very tricky question. What is the emphasis here? The emphasis here, I think, is probably on building civil society. Lenin is very much into Soviets, into arming the people, into, you know, having a state that actually is made up of elected officials that are paid an average work person's wage. I think the emphasis is much more Gramscian here, building a self-organized, collectively self-organized civil society. In fact, we can reduce these two roads to two pictures. I'm going to show what is going on in the National Bourgeois Road, as opposed to the national liberation struggle that leads to socialism. And this leads to what? Dictatorship. What? The argument is, if this is the expansion of civil society, under colonialism, civil society at best is bifurcated, where it's relatively thin. And then with the struggle against colonialism, institutions of civil society are built. And then they reach a peak. And then what happens to civil society from a multi-party democracy, a one-party state, one-party dictatorship, one-man dictatorship, despotism, and civil society diminishes to nothing? That's the national bourgeois road. Fanon says, well, we can say that the same thing happens in the beginning from colonialism, anti-colonialism, and then It increases. Uh-huh. There we have socialism up here. Bob's your uncle again. Yes. Here we have colonialism. Here we have the independence struggle, independence, and here we have the final transition to socialism. And here, colonialism. Here we have independence, and here we have dictatorship. When civil society crumbles to nothing, there is no autonomous civil society. Okay. Isn't that beautiful? What's your problem, Matthew?
Oh, what's the middle level for the national?
Independence. Colonialism, independence, and then dictatorship or socialism. Okay, Jason number two. What's the problem with this picture, Jason number two? What do you think of this trajectory of socialism? Socialism.
There's a Bob's your uncle theory.
Well, yeah, eventually there's a Bob's your uncle theory, but there's also something else. It happens where? In what context does this socialism happen? In what context? In what framework? In what space, Neil?
I was going to ask, do both of these lead to sovereignty?
Well, yes, you can say it leads to sovereignty and national independence. You know, you've got countries all over Africa. Whether it's the Congo, whether it's Tanzania, whether it's Algeria, they have, in a sense, national sovereignty. Depends what you mean by sovereignty. Certainly, these are national entities, one characterized by dictatorship. Well, the question is, did it ever happen? Oh! No. No. Once again. Flawed again. The last day of class, flawed again. Didn't happen. Didn't happen. Didn't happen. What we got was the left-hand side, but we didn't get the right-hand side. There were national liberation struggles, but they didn't succeed in delivering socialism. Why not? Why not? Why not? Come on. Now be Marxist about this. Sienna. Because the modes of production were not ready. That would be an orthodox Marxist argument. Indeed, that the economy was not sufficiently developed. Yes, one could argue that. That's right, that the economy was not fully developed. But what other reasons? What other reasons might we, given a Gramscian sort of framework, what other reasons? Remember, there were three moments to a social situation analysis. There was the political moment, Greg, which is what we've talked about in the middle board. But there were two other moments. The economic and the military. Now, this is where it gets interesting. What were the military conditions? See, Fanon thought that you could build what? Socialism in one country. And he thought, interestingly enough, that, and you can read this on pages, since I'm going to have to summarize. You can read this. Well, yes. Well, first, I'll give you the pages in a second. The first, he thought that the colonizers and the metropolitan countries, that they would essentially do what? That they wouldn't want to engage in violence. And it has some interesting on pages 65, 66, and other places. He says that, yes, it is true that the balance of military force favors the colonizers, and they are not going to be happy with the idea of socialism. But he says, interesting enough, that monopoly capital, organized capital, finance capital, don't like to engage in violence. Well, we know better that in fact states where in fact finance capital is dominant, are very happy sometimes to engage in violent occupations and to display violence. So I think Fanon was on the one side very, very optimistic about the reticence of Western countries to actually deploy violence. But there's a much more important argument, and that is the economic argument. Because what was Marx's original argument about socialism in one country? It would get what? It will get suffocated by the surrounding capitalist context. How does Fanon answer that question? Well, you can read about that on pages 102, 103, 103, 104, 106. And what does he say? He essentially says, well, what do you think he might say? How might Africa, socialist Africa, fend off capitalist Europe, capitalist United States? Yes, Matthew?
Create an African bloc of nations.
They can create an African bloc of nations in which the African bloc of nations will make themselves indispensable to Western capitalism, because Western capitalism needs what? Markets and natural resources. And Fanon argues that in fact Africa will save capitalism from the crises of overproduction, because it will provide markets, and therefore, even if it's socialist, the Western capitalists will leave it alone. In fact, he says at one point that Western capitalists owe Africa reparations. Imagine that. Can you imagine the United States, Britain, Germany, France giving reparations to colonial Africa? Or post-colonial Africa? It's difficult to imagine. So he is totally optimistic and exaggeratedly so in understanding the balance of global forces. But he says, and this is his final culminating moment, he says, I know, I mustn't be too optimistic. I mustn't exaggerate the possibilities. Ultimately, this is going to depend upon what? Socialism in Africa is going to depend upon what?
Socialism in the West.
Simeon?
Socialism in the West.
Socialism in the West. Where does he say that?
Right on the last line.
Right on the last line, Simeon. You're going to read them out. Page 106, the most extraordinary comments, fascinating. And I want you to start on the last page into the new paragraph, 2, 4, 5, 6 lines into the new paragraph.
What?
Yes, what it?
What did it?
Now it is the third world. The third world, the post-colonial world. What if?
What it expects.
What the third world expects
from those who for centuries have kept it in slavery,
the third world, Africa, in slavery,
is that they will help it to rehabilitate mankind and make man victorious in everywhere.
So look, it's read as follows. Let me do it. It's important. What the third world expects from those who for centuries have kept it in slavery is that they, the first world, will help it to rehabilitate mankind and make man victorious everywhere once and for all. That is to say, there will be in some sense a collaboration of first and third world to build socialism on earth. Yes, continue, Simeon. Yes, but it is clear.
It is clear that we are not so naive as to think that this will come about with the cooperation of the goodwill of the European
countries. Ah, we are not so naive after all. Yes, continue.
This huge task, which consists of reintroducing mankind into the world, the whole of mankind, will be carried out with the indispensable help of the European people.
And in particular, the European working class.
Who themselves must realize that in the past they have often joined the ranks of our common masters who were colonial, where colonial questions were
concerned. Aha! The workers in the West have joined forces with the dominant classes in the West to perpetrate colonialism in Africa. Aha! Go on.
To achieve this, the European people must first decide to wake up and shake themselves, use their brains, and stop playing the stupid game of the sleeping beauty.
There he is referring to the working class of the West, including the American working class. To achieve this, the European peoples must first decide to wake up and shake themselves, use their brain, and stop playing the stupid game of the sleeping beauty. So in the end, he appeals to what? To revolution in the West. Once again, a necessary condition for the possibility of socialism in Africa. So whereas there may well have been socialist tendencies, even national liberation struggles, and you're going to read about a national liberation struggle not in the West, not in Africa, but of course in Cuba. But the point is that there have been national liberation struggles, but in the end, Fanon is naive about the constraints under which such socialist projects take place, both in the military terms and in economic terms, and in his presumption that there will be a revolution in the West. We've read Gramsci and we know what? How difficult it is to organize that revolution in the West. So again, once again, we've come to a full stop. Yes. Any thoughts? So what does Fanon say? Dictatorship or socialism? We don't like dictatorship, but socialism, it turns out now, is what? Stacy. Tracy. Too difficult, we might say even impossible. Socialism in one country is so difficult. That's why the Cuban story is a fascinating story. That's why you're going to enjoy the next 2 weeks so much. Yes, last.
Isn't it true that those who tried on the national liberation road, didn't that end up exactly like in the national bourgeoisie road, like for example in Zimbabwe?
Yes. Beautiful. Let us see. Yes, very good. Yes, shoo! That's what you say. And this? That's what you're saying, right? Yeah. I think that's right. I mean, what we have to do with Fanon, look, we have to be sociologists. We have to stop this Manichaean distinction between a national bourgeois road and a national liberation struggle. We've got to be much more sophisticated in understanding what those roads to decolonization are. We have much more sophisticated apparatus and conceptual framework to understand the variety of paths out of the colonialism than actually Fanon did. This idea of national bourgeois road, dictatorship, national liberation, socialism is just not adequate to the history of Africa. Juliana.
And he
Well, yeah, he's got a sort of Marxist, but it's a Gramsci, I'm trying to get this point, it's a Gramsci analysis in the sense that he's basically saying that the national bourgeois road is not going to lead to a true national bourgeoisie, but an imitative national bourgeoisie. One that, you see, what we have, to some extent in this country and in Europe, a bourgeoisie, a dominant class, a capitalist class that is able to grant concessions, continues to reproduce a rudimentary civil society that does allow education and social mobility, that does allow freedom of expression and organization. It is a self-confident bourgeoisie that is able to even grant concessions to the working class, though we haven't seen many of them over the last 20 years. But we will see them come January 20th. Yes. We'll see, right. Very good, Simeon. Yes. So I mean, the point is that there, in the West, there is a bourgeoisie that is self-confident enough to grant space and concessions to subordinate classes. In Africa, the bourgeoisie cannot do that. It has not got the power, the capacities, the resources to actually create that space or the self-confidence. And therefore, national bourgeois road leads to dictatorship. On top of which, the national bourgeoisie is an appendage of the bourgeoisie in the West. It is not really a source of genuine accumulation. That's the argument. It's a very Gramscian argument. Is Gramsci applied to Africa? Even if he never read Gramsci. It must be, you know, if two people have the same framework in their heads, it must be true. It's two brilliant people. I mean, independently, I mean, he must be. All right. Even though I guess Fanon was much more optimistic than, well, more optimistic in many ways than Gramsci. who had seen the failure of revolution in a way that Fanon had not. Who knows what Fanon would be writing today if he were alive? Or if he'd been alive even 10 or 15 years after he died in the middle 1970s. He would have said, oh, well, I told you so. But what would he have said about socialism? Interesting question. Doesn't matter. Next point. Next point. Because Fanon has been appropriated in different parts of the world in different ways. And what is really fascinating is the way that Fanon's writings, in particular The Wretched of the Earth, has been appropriated in the United States of America. Fanon, as you can see already, had a view of the West that was really almost identical to Gramsci's view of the West, namely the constitution of this bourgeois hegemony and all that it entails and how different it was to the colonial rule. That was Fanon's view. That was Fanon's view of the West. However, there were people who appropriated Fanon who had a different view of the West. The Black Panthers down the road in Oakland, Huey Newton, Bobby Seale, Eldridge Cleaver. They took The Wretched of the Earth as the Bible for what? Revolution in the United States of America. What was their argument? What was their argument? What could their argument be? It's not Fanon's argument, but they took Fanon's argument to the United States and used this as the Bible for revolution in the United States of America. What was their argument? Sonny?
Would it be that violence was the only way to overturn hegemony?
Right, one could argue that violence was the center, yes. Yes, maybe. Certain, yes. Neil?
You could see the civil rights movement through nonviolent struggle as the national boudoir movement simply just adding black people into a position to get white people.
That's the civil rights movement.
That was the traditional civil rights movement.
Right.
The king was a part of, so then they would see themselves as one of the
Black Panthers see themselves as the
national liberation.
But then who are the peasants then? Who represents the peasantry in this framework? What is the equivalent of the peasantry in this framework? Who is going to be the revolutionary agent equivalent to the peasantry? Sienna.
Black masses.
The black masses. The oppressed people, colored people of the United States of America. Whether they be Native Americans, whether they be African Americans, whether they be Hispanic population, they are going to be seen as the vehicle, as the foundation, as the crucible of a revolutionary force. Because they are what? They are subject to what? Some form of what? Violence, but a particular form of rule called colonialism. And they call it in the United States internal colonialism. It's as if the African American population, Hispanic population, Native American, are in a colony that resides within the metropolis, an internal colony. So there is a sense, a model of racial order as a colonial order in the United States too. And therefore, it is the colonized, the people of color who become a revolutionary force in the imagination of the Black Panthers as they appropriate Fanon. Yeah. Now this is very different to Gramsci. This is very different to Marx. This is very different to Lenin. Because for Marx, Lenin, Gramsci, which is the revolutionary force in the United States of America? The working class. And indeed it was for Fanon. Now, what is the difference in the theory of revolution? And this is the crux and the heart of the matter. What is the difference in the theory of revolution that we are observing here? Two, Fanon versus the Marxists. What is the difference in the theory of revolution? The theory of the revolutionary agent, Jason.
Is it a matter of who's the most oppressed or who has the 15th?
Ah, very good, very good, very good. Yes, yes, say more, say more. Who is whom?
I'll let someone else answer that.
Ah, uh-huh. What is the difference here between theories of revolutionary agency? On the one hand, we have the view taken of the Black Panthers that it is the colonized, the excluded, that become revolutionary agents, as opposed to Marx and Gramsci and Lenin, who say it is the who. Who's going to be the revolutionary class? Not the excluded, but the alienated. Exploited, triple B. Well done. Yes. Very good, Sonny. Yes. Isn't that interesting? Yes, 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 yes. Yes, 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 yes. This is tiring class. Yes. Yes, yes. Let me just draw this picture properly. Okay. I'm going to give you an advanced capitalism, the USA. Third world colony, global south, colony and post-colony, if you will. That's the one dimension. And the other dimension is to talk about the exploited classes and the excluded classes. The incorporated classes, the marginalized classes, dispossessed classes. Ha-ha! The exploited under advanced capitalism, they are called the what? The proletariat. We'll call them the working class. And they are the revolutionary force according to Gramsci, Fanon, everybody, you know. Fanon thinks the same, actually, in his writings, Marx, so on. Who are the exploited, incorporated under the third in a third world colony? Who represents the incorporated, the exploited here? The working class too. The working class, plus you might say the national bourgeoisie, who represent the working class. Yes. And it's not clear who is defending this as a revolution. They are not a revolutionary class. Not revolutionary. Nobody seems to, except perhaps the national bourgeoisie themselves, they may think they are revolutionary. But they're not revolutionary. Now we talked about the excluded. Who are the excluded under advanced capitalism? Felipe. The excluded, the marginalized under advanced capitalism in the United States.
Immigrants.
The racialized minorities, if you accept that expression, which embraces a large number of different categories. Racialized minorities. The colonized, the internally colonized. Internally colonized. Internally colonized, meaning being the colony is within the United States. You can indeed say that African Americans and ghettos are in fact colonized. And many people have, even in this department, a fellow by the name of Robert Blown. Has anybody read ever Robert Blown's book, Racial Oppression in America? Very famous book in the 1970s and 80s. It depicts exactly this idea of the colonial model as a way of understanding racial domination in this society. And the Black Panthers argue that this, the Black Panthers argue that this is the revolutionary class. And the Black Panthers actually start out by building a war of position, a civil society, and then they face the full mighty force, the violence of the state, and then they too become violent. But they are actually expressing the idea that the excluded are a revolutionary class. And who are the excluded here? The peasantry. And Fanon is arguing that they are the revolutionary class. In the third world, in the colonized world. We have here two fundamentally different theories of revolutionary agency, which is what Jason was getting at. We have the idea that it is the exploited who are the revolutionary agent. Because they're exploited, because capital depends upon the workers, workers withdraw their labor power, that means they have power. It is because they are at the center of production. It is because they produce things collectively, transform nature together, that they can build that revolutionary consciousness. That is the Marxian argument. The Fanonite argument, it is those excluded, those who have nothing to lose, the oppressed, the outsiders, who are the revolutionary force. Not the working class, but the racial minorities in this context. Two profoundly different theories of revolutionary agency. Those who are integrated and exploited, as opposed to those who are excluded. Yes. And I leave you with a question to think about over the break as to which, perhaps, is the better theory, the more accurate theory of revolutionary agent. Is it the excluded or the exploited that become a revolutionary force? Aha! Okay. Yes. Any questions on that? Josephine. In Latin America. Well, one could argue that, in fact, these uprisings around privatization are often those who are the excluded or exploited. Is this the struggle of the excluded or the exploited? What do you think? The indigenous movements of Bolivia?
Excluded.
I think, you know, there's a lot of evidence that the excluded turn out to be quite a potent revolutionary force. Whether they can ultimately deliver a revolution is another matter, but at least they seem to be the insurgent forces in many parts of the world today. Those excluded from access to the means of production. Those excluded from such mundane necessities of life, like water and electricity and housing, those excluded from it turn out to be the insurgent. And the working classes often turn out to be, as Fanon describes them, a much more labor aristocracy in the global south. Sienna.
Well, what about, like, in the Cuban Revolution thing that we just read?
Ah.
I don't think the middle class intellectuals were neither excluded nor exploited.
Neither excluded nor exploited. And what about them?
Why then was their, you know, revolution other than sheer madness?
Well, yes, that's an interesting question. What does Fanon have to say about the intellectuals?
That they
have rubbed him off, but still. But what's those intellectuals? I mean, what does Fanon say about those intellectuals and the peasantry? They team up together. And so it is the intellectuals expelled from the towns. Those students who campaign for human rights and discover what? A military regime against them. Who flee and discover the possibility of actually joining forces with the peasantry. It is a Fanonite analysis, one could argue. Yeah, it's an interesting question. Why some students are very conservative and some are radical? A question you should ask yourselves. Right, Jason? Oh, look at Jason's smile. It's the first time I got a smile out of you. Very good. Yes. Yes. Okay. Yes. It's an interesting question. The middle classes, aspiring middle classes, students. Who are students? Why do they have a particular political orientation that they do? Interesting question. Who are those people expelled from the cities in the colonial context? Who are those dissidents? Good question. Now we're on to ransacking. 3 minutes for ransacking. You know, I know I've worn you out. Well, what would be your problems with Fanon? Come on, quick. What would be your problems with Fanon? Simeon.
How are you supposed to win over the lump?
Okay, how are you supposed to win over the lumpen proletariat since they seem to be so voluble and uncertain? Good question. All right, very good. Greg? Sorry?
I had a problem with the way that, like, Fanon is describing how the colonized, like, they hate the Western values, and yet they depend on the West to help fund their socialism, you know, to help them create socialism in Africa. I mean,
Yes, there is a paradox that they're living in a capitalist world and they want to revolt against the capitalist world and they're a weak country. How is not Fanon a little bit naive about that possibility? Yes, indeed. Yes, indeed, but of course that's right. All right, let's move on. Yes, Juliana. No? More criticisms. Come on, you've been shoved this down your throat for three sessions now. You need to have a bit of catharsis. You need to deliver. Yes?
I mean, you touched on this a little bit already, but basically how he counterposes the National Liberation Road and the National Reform, he's arguing against the idea of that.
Yes, it's too so stark a dichotomy, dictatorship or socialism. That's not going to help us analyze Africa. It helps us to give this as a vision of what was possible. But then, of course, we discover also that his vision for socialism turns out to be based on all sorts of dubious assumptions about the character of global capitalism. Yes, any more thoughts? Any more thoughts? Yes, Neil.
Let me seem to be all about violence, which I don't inherently have a problem with. But I just think he seems to think that he can somehow channel everyone into being violent towards the same objective and not doing what Africa.
Yes, I mean, there is this problematic feature of violence and the danger that violence gets out of hand. Yes, and how does one channel it? One has to, of course, well, presumably have to have a very powerful modern prince to orchestrate it. But nevertheless, that is, of course, another feature that we have harped upon, that he harps upon, that is perhaps problematic. What do we do with his ideas of violence, however necessary they may be to dislodge colonialism? Yes, very good. Any more criticisms? Yes, is that Claudette?
Intellectuals to help the peasantry, which is kind of, I mean, compared to Marx. Marx is saying that the lower classes have to evolve their own consciousness.
Very good. Very good. And that they will, that they, through struggle, they will develop an understanding of the world. And Fanon is insisting on the role of intellectuals. And he's assuming that there can be some sort of synergy between these radical intellectuals and the peasantry. And there is the danger that one will dominate the other. That's your, quote, elitism, right?
Yes.
And, of course, Gramsci talks about what? The organic intellectual. And for many people, the organic intellectual is an intellectual that is elaborated from within the peasantry. These are intellectuals coming from the towns. Can they develop a synergistic relationship with the peasantry? Did Castro and his friends, comrades, develop such a synergistic relationship with the peasantry of Cuba? Yes. Yes, I saw a hand up over here. No? Matthew.
So Gramsci says that the peasantry can't develop organic intellectuals?
Yes, that's another thing. Gramsci. Say it for me, Juliana, one last time. Antonio Gramsci.
Antonio Gramsci.
Thank you. Yes, Antonio Gramsci says, in fact, the peasants cannot elaborate their own intellectuals, and therefore one might argue that they have to come from outside. But Gramsci would also say that the peasantry is not revolutionary. And of course, one might argue that the peasantry are not revolutionary. Why? Because they can't have intellectuals. Very tricky stuff. Very tricky stuff. Well, I think you've ransacked this poor fellow enough. Yes. Well, I guess the other thing that that's everything that I've got except for the peasant revolt. He sort of homogenizes the peasantry. It really doesn't explain, which is Jason's question. Why is it that the peasantry are so revolutionary? And can one homogenize the peasantry in the way that he does? In Algeria, there were very differentiated class. Some were wage laborers and some were basically landless peasants and some were actually small farmers. These are different groups. So I think a more sociological analysis of the peasantry is called for, Neil.
I don't mean to go backwards, but you just said that you don't think Gramsci would acknowledge that the peasantry is revolutionary, but I thought that he was giving credit to Russia in the fact that they are a most nation.
Yes, but the peasantry was led by the revolutionary working class, even for Gramsci. Yes, indeed, the peasantry provided the dynamite of the Russian Revolution, but they were led by the working class, which gave them direction. So I think Gramsci was still, he, like all the other Marxists, very, very suspicious of these characters and the lumpen proletariat. Okay, stop, finished, ransacked over, 10 minutes left. Summary. Boy, whirlwind tour. Okay, let's see if I can do it in 6 minutes. If it's a good course, then I can do it in 6 minutes. If a bad course, I can't. A good course is one that can be simplified. Do its essentials. Okay. Are you ready? Marx and Engels. They had a theory of capitalism. A brilliant theory of capitalism. Absolutely brilliant. It went as follows. Early capitalism, under competition, led to crises and class struggle that coincided so that capitalism gave rise to what? Socialism. That's it. That's Marx and Engels in a nutshell. Okay, we'll put them in a triangle. There were some problems with this. Okay, what were the problems? Well, first of all, we had a problem of the state. They just didn't take into account that the state can reorganize capitalism. They had an undeveloped theory of the state. Had some good intuitions, but were off the mark in the final analysis. They didn't see how important the state was. Transition. They had a Bob's your uncle theory of transition. It just happened. Bob's your uncle. It was no theory of transition, really. And finally, they had a faulty theory of class struggle. One that said struggle leads to struggle leads to struggle leads to more struggle than revolution. No good. Struggle leads to reform, leads to the organization of the working class. All right. Then, who comes next? A fellow called Lenin. Lenin says, okay, we better have a better theory of the state, and we better have a better theory of transition. So, here's Lenin. Whoops. Ruling class, working class, military, bureaucracy, the moon, very thin. Thousand threads, the real action. And that leads to what? Octopus. The D of P. D of P. Okay. That's Lenin. Brilliant. Huge innovation. He didn't have much of an analysis of class struggle in state and revolution, though he did have an analysis of class struggle elsewhere. In, for example, a book called What Is to Be Done, one of Mike Levien's favorite books, actually. He loves What Is to Be Done. But anyway, we didn't read about it. So that's Lenin. Now, Gramsci. Gramsci. Gramsci says to Lenin, you can't generalize your theory. That's true. This is all true. This war of movement is true for Russia, but not for the rest of the world, not for other countries, not for countries with advanced civil society. So what he says is that advanced capitalism has an elaborated state on top of an economic base filled with a rich, deep, thick civil society. And it is on the terrain of civil society that revolutionary struggles must be made. And so what he says is that we have to think of the political realm as a struggle for hegemony on the terrain of civil society, which takes place inside economic limits and inside military limits. And there are three levels to which classes can aspire in fighting this political struggle. So that's Gramsci. And Fanon says to Gramsci, okay, fine. I agree with you entirely about the West, but I'm actually concerned with the colonial context. And in the colonial context, your ideas have some applicability, but we have to readapt them. And we get a picture that looks like this. The metropolis, settlers, administrative order. And then we have two blocks, an urban block, with a national bourgeoisie, a working class, and an rural bloc with rural leaders and a peasantry and a lumpen proletariat caught between the two. And what essentially Fanon says is that we have to see the struggle against colonialism as a war of movement on the one side and a war of position on the other. A war of position that will determine what will be the character of the post-colony, whether it will be a national bourgeois road to dictatorship or a national liberation struggle to socialism. And that's where we are. Wasn't that brilliant? Yes. 5 minutes. 5 minutes. All right. Now what? Good. Look. What we're going to do next semester... Oh, yeah, Jessica?
Do you have extra time?
I got a minute or two, yeah.
Lenin and Gramsci theory for us, like
pictures. Well, there we go. Basically, Gramsci says to Lenin, that's Russia. That's Russia. War of movement, then war of position. And Gramsci says, yes, true of Russia, but in the West, it's war of position and war of movement. But basically, you've got this civil society. Jason disagrees, but Gramsci says that civil society is strong in the West.
So can you compare Gramsci to Fanon?
Oh, you're in a shifting ground again. Fanon says to Gramsci, yes, you're dead right. That's absolutely true. This is the West, but I'm interested in the colonial context. So here we have to look at the war of position within the colonized. We're in a very different context. So basically, Lenin talks to Marx, Gramsci talks to Lenin, and Fanon talks to Gramsci. Beautiful. It's symmetry. It's brilliant. It's Marxism. But next semester, you are going to have the chance to criticize. Every one of the theorists that we deal with next semester will be critical of one or other of these theorists. Next semester is the anti-Marxism semester, what you've been waiting for. And you're going to be so excited and thrilled by reading Durkheim and Weber and Foucault and finally feminism. Okay, now let me finish. What have I got to say to you? Okay. Let's shush. Okay, look. This has been quite an extraordinary semester. For internal and external reasons, right? I mean, it's been memorable because we have lived through an extraordinary period of US history. And you have had the luxury of actually following it through with theory. There has been a sort of, what can we call it? The second time I'll use the word today, dialectical, very good, Conrad. A dialectical relationship between the world out there and the world in here. And we shall continue to try to do that. Now, I would like, first of all, to thank you, because it's been memorable for me, because, of course, I've had a good time with you. You will find you in the most adorable set of people, particularly even when you looked completely exhausted, which was relatively rare since it's 3:30 to 5 in the afternoon. It's pretty difficult. So I really would like to thank you for all participation. It's actually, I can't remember such a vigorous participation, and I like to think that you were engaged in the world beyond that sort of brought it into the classroom. But I think we also have to recognize that the real source of your energy and enthusiasm, your willingness to talk, your disciplined activity, your behavior as a group like a modern princes and princesses, the inspiration, of course, lies with your graduate student instructors. They're here. They will be with you next semester. You are very lucky. They are the cream of the crop, dedicated and devoted. They work many hours beyond their duty. And as you know, they produced already some wonderful blogs, and you will see even emerging books about your commentaries on what was happening this last semester. So I'm hoping that next semester will be as exciting as this one, and that you will have a wonderful, refreshing holiday after you finish the examination of the Cuban Revolution. So, thank you very much.